From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. In the United States alone, doctors have performed over 8,000 organ and tissue transplants just since the start of this year. Yet the imbalance between the supply of organs for transplant and the demand for them can be staggering. About 75,000 people are active on the national waiting list for an organ transplant right now, and on average, 20 people die each day. Now, globally, the situation is even worse. The international shortage of transplantable organs has led to a booming underground industry known as the red market, where people illegally buy and sell human body parts to the highest bidder. Now, horror stories associated with the red market will sometimes catch international headlines, like the 2013 case of a young boy in China who had his eyes stolen, likely for the use of his corneas. But day-to-day, the red market operates like a business. Many people desperate for cash will offer organs like a kidney to brokers willing to pay a lofty price, sometimes over $5,000. But it's those handling the deal who really bring in the money. Someone in need of a transplant may pay tens of thousands of dollars for that same kidney, leading to a huge profit for traffickers. Now, by some estimates, around 10% of all transplanted organs globally come from the red market. So on this edition of Global Journalist, we're looking at how this shortage of organ donors has ballooned into a lucrative underground market and how efforts to squash it are shaping international policy. In a few minutes, we'll hear from people with knowledge of different aspects of this trade. We'll start with Campbell Fraser in Brisbane, Australia. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of International Business and Asian Studies at Griffith University, who researches the organ trade. He's also a transplant recipient himself. Campbell, welcome.
I'm great. Great to be with you.
Give us just a quick overview as to how the legal organ donation system works in most countries.
Well, there's basically two individual systems. There are countries that have a deceased donation model where there is a waiting list for organs for people who are waiting for a transplant. In countries like the US, here in Australia, most of Western Europe. And in those situations, a patient may wait 3, 4, sometimes 5 years for an organ for transplantation. That deceased organ donation is backed up by a live donor program. So if somebody who's in need of a kidney has a loved one or a close friend who's willing to donate an organ to them, then a live donation may occur if there is compatibility with the donor and recipient, and both are healthy enough to do that. So really, in the Western developed countries, it's primarily a deceased donation system backed up by a live donation system.
And this is these are incredibly, at least in the United States, incredibly expensive operations. A heart transplant operation can cost more than $1 million. A kidney transplant operation can cost something like $415,000. But the actual cost of the organ is not really a significant part of that.
That's true. One of the basic principles of deceased organ donation is that no money is changing hands for that organ. What you're paying for the hospital fees, the surgeon fees, the medication, the follow-up treatment. In transplantation, it's actually the follow-up treatment is the main cost. The surgery is just one of many steps in bringing someone back to good health. I mean, it can take, 3 to 4 months after the transplant for health to be restored. So, it's a long, drawn-out process, therefore extremely expensive.
And yes. Campbell Fraser, you mentioned that the wait times can be very long, and so some people may look to sort of the informal market to buy a kidney if they think they may die before they get one through the legal route. So how do people access this sort of red market of organs?
The patients who decide after maybe they've been waiting a few years, or alternatively, patients who are in developing countries where there's no deceased donation system available. So, for some patients in countries that don't have deceased donation, then buying an organ is actually their only real option. So what happens in those situations is that there's this patient-to-patient network where if somebody has purchased an organ on the black market, they will share that information with other people who are looking for an organ. And this is what we're really seeing now in a really the last 3 to 4 years, is like Facebook discussion groups, patient-to-patient networks. And that is how patients are now learning of the opportunities to receive an organ on the black market. In the past, before we had a number of crackdowns on this, you could find organs being openly advertised on sale on bulletin boards in newspapers. Now it's moved underground. So what we're seeing now is it's all going online. Social media is now the principal way that a patient would find out how to find that organ. So what would happen is somebody goes to one of these countries, obtains an organ. When they come back, they can themselves often become brokers themselves, because what happens is the patient will say go to a country where these illegal transplants happen. For example, at the moment, Egypt is a major country where that's happening. And the broker will tell that person who's buying the organ, well, if you go back to your home country and you can find me more patients, I'll give you a 10% commission. Now, if I have just spent $110,000 is about the going rate at the moment, then I'm going to be feeling pretty poor. I may have mortgaged my house, I may have taken loans, I may have borrowed money from friends and relatives. So if I can find more patients to send there, then I'm going to get my money back. So it's kind of working in this scheme now of patient to patient network. So that's
Campbell, you did mention, our time does grow short, but you did mention Egypt and one of the hotspots actually as a source country for organs that are sold is Syrian refugees. And so I understand you've spent some time interviewing people who have traveled to get organs donated by people fleeing the war in Syria. Tell us just briefly about that.
One of the really interesting things about the organ trade is world events dictate where donors are coming from. So Egypt has for many years been a problematic country because there are a number of doctors there that have the expertise to perform transplants, but there's very poor regulatory oversight. So what has been happening is that refugees from other countries are heading to Egypt in order to sell an organ. So what happens with the Syrian refugees? They're going across the border into Lebanon. They end up, ultimately, they're looking to get to Europe, but they've run out of money. The people traffickers are asking for more money. So therefore, as a way of raising that money, they're lured into meeting the brokers who are offering them maybe $2,500, $3,000 for a kidney, which they will then travel to Egypt and have that organ removed. So that's the basic mechanics of how that happens. But what the real sad part of this is, yes, they do get the money for the organ. Often they get a lot less than they've originally been promised. But because of the really crude surgical methods that are used in the removal of that organ, they have lifelong disability, chronic pain, often really horrific infections. And from that, they're just no longer strong enough to continue that journey. So what I have seen are a number of people who tried to make that migration journey, but the sale of the kidney has left them with permanent disability, permanent disfigurement. Well, and that's really the end of the journey for them. They end up getting stuck there in Egypt. Also seeing patients coming through, the sellers coming through Libya as well. They're in refugee camps in Libya and coming into Egypt, and then they end up just stuck there.
Well, Campbell Fraser, I'm sorry, we're just out of time, but thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the international shortage of human organs needed to perform transplants. Now, one country, Iran, has taken a different approach. It's the only nation in the world that lets people legally sell organs like their kidneys. Here to talk with us about Iran's government-regulated marketplace for organs and human tissues is Shashank Bengali. He's the South Asia correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's reported on issues with the organ shortages from Iran as well as from India. Shashank, welcome.
Hey, good to be with you.
Well, talk to us just about the approach that Iran has taken in addressing a shortage of transplantable organs.
So as you said, Iran is the only country in the world that offers people a legal way to sell their organs and their kidneys, and it's the only place where this is done. There's a government foundation. It registers buyers and sellers. It matches them up. It sets a fixed price, which last year was about $4,600 per organ. And in the last 25 years, they've performed about 30,000 kidney transplants this way. And the Iranian authorities say this is a humane way for people who need kidneys to receive them in a clear, transparent system. And for people who want to part with a non-vital organ, it's a way for them to do so in a way that's safe. However, what we learned when we went to Tehran last year was that the system doesn't always work quite so cleanly. You know, there's a fixed price, but sellers have learned that they can cut side deals to make thousands of dollars more from eager buyers. And there's also been a number of stories in the Iranian press about doctors who have been caught performing transplants for foreigners, usually Saudi Arabians, on fake IDs. Fake Iranian IDs.
And I think from your reporting, you showed that, you know, as you discussed, there's this black market, but you said people actually hang flyers in the street advertising their kidneys. And so it seemed like one of the ways you found would be kidney donors was just by responding to these ads that are posted in the street.
Well, this is one of the amazing things. If you go to some of the main kidney hospitals in Tehran, you'll see these flyers plastered everywhere. You know, it's basically, you know, like guitar lessons, you know, on a street corner in Brooklyn, those flyers where you just kind of pull off a sticker with the phone number on it. This is the same way people are advertising their kidneys for sale. Now, it's not clear if any people are actually selling kidneys in this way. The government says that they don't take any of those sellers and add them to the system, to the official system. However, what it does show is that there is a huge amount of desperation. You know, Campbell mentioned that world events and news events drive many of the trends in organ sales. And in Iran, it's no different. I mean, this is a country that's suffering from severe economic hardship, years of economic sanctions, corruption and unemployment, and people who we met, these are folks who are in bankruptcy, who've lost their jobs, lost their businesses. They're looking for ways to earn a quick buck, and they're trying to sell their kidneys.
And so from the perspective of the people who need a transplant, does the Iranian system work well for them?
Well, it really depends. You know, Iran says that they've done away with the wait list by setting things up in this system. But actually, we learned that you still have to wait up to a year, sometimes longer, to get a transplant in Iran. There are certainly people who have gotten kidneys in this way and who are perfectly happy. The transplants, as far as we've understood, are performed in proper hospitals under safe conditions. You know, those who are matched up are often quite pleased. But as we learned, you know, there's still this black market out there, and it's not very clear that Iranian authorities have a great grasp of what's happening, particularly in outlying provinces beyond the capital, where there could be illicit operations happening away from their scrutiny.
And Shashank, before I let you go, I wanted to touch on your reporting in India. You wrote a story about a young man who sort of blew the whistle on an organ theft scheme, it seemed like, there. Talk to us just about that.
Well, so India is quite interesting, too. Because of changing diets and sort of increasing prosperity in India, there's a huge incidence of diabetes, and that's one of the reasons why people require kidney transplants if things get to an advanced stage. And India unlike the U.S., doesn't have a system or harvest, actually, I should say, very, very few organs from deceased donors. So the vast majority of transplants are done in India through living donors. And because of the government's desire to crack down on sort of make this process more transparent, they've passed laws that say that only close relatives can donate kidneys and other organs in rare exceptions. And this has given rise to a whole problem of forged documents inside hospitals. And every year or two, there's a quote-unquote kidney scam at a hospital. We covered one 2 years ago at one of the biggest hospitals in Mumbai, where a dozen medical staff were arrested for participating in a system that was forging documents to get kidneys from unrelated donors and recipients. And this happens every so often, and you know, it's because there's a massive supply and demand problem. Indians, the research suggests that about 220,000 Indians need kidneys, and India performs only about 8,000 transplants a year. So it's just a numbers game.
Well, Shashank Bhangali, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
To broaden our discussion on the organ trade, we're joined now by Dominique Martin, a senior lecturer in health ethics at Deakin University in Melbourne. She spent 10 years researching solutions to organ trafficking and transplant tourism. Also joining us is Brendan Parent. He's the director of applied bioethics at New York University's School of Professional Studies, where he focuses on ethical issues regarding transplant medicine. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Dominique Martin, I'll go to you first. Tell us what sorts of international conventions are there governing this trade in kidneys and other organs?
Probably the most important one is the World Health Organization's Guiding Principles on Human Cell, Tissue, and Organ Transplantation. That's a document that was first introduced in the very early 1990s in response to growing concern about a burgeoning organ market around the world. Those principles really articulated the standards that the international community of transplant professionals, health authorities, feels should govern all of our practices in donation and transplantation. And although those principles have been revised regularly throughout the years, the basic tenets remain the same. And those principles have then been picked up in other documents, in particular the Declaration of Istanbul against organ trafficking and transplant tourism, which was first published about 10 years ago this year. They would be, I guess, two of the really important ones, but we've had other organizations, the World Medical Association, and then at the regional level, the Council of Europe has a convention, and really around the world, many countries have put together statements, really, which set forth the same standards and the opposition to trafficking.
Well, Brendan Parent, you heard Shashank Bhangali describing the marketplace in Iran, and he mentioned that there are some problems with how that market functions. But in theory, if a market like that, it didn't have some of the operational problems that Shashank described, are there some ethical problems with paying donors to give their kidney?
Sure. With human organs, they are inelastic goods, right? I mean, this is a problem of coercion that people who are going to consider selling their organs generally don't have money for basic needs. And they're going to be offered sums which are far greater than the amount they're used to. So the choice isn't really a real choice.
Well, Dominique Martin, if you could pick up on that point, then do you also see this as problematic then? I mean, Iran would say, look, we've eliminated the wait times for transplant recipients. In other words, people aren't dying waiting for organs anymore.
I completely agree with Brendan there. And I think the evidence from around the world shows that the people who do sell, by and large, are people in desperate circumstances who are exploited and or coerced. From a more practical perspective, I would say it's very important also to point out that the Iranian system has not been successful, that the claims that they've eliminated the waiting list have been disproven. And another country, in fact, that for some years has been paying up to $15,000 for not just a living donor, but also for a deceased organ donor, is Saudi Arabia, and they've got very big waiting lists. They haven't increased their rates despite increasing prices or increasing offers to people. So it also just doesn't work. There aren't either that many desperate people, or it's not going to be the most effective solution to the organ shortage.
Well, and Brendan, how difficult is it to enforce sort of rules against people traveling from one country to another to receive an organ? I mean, could you be arrested for traveling from the United States or from another country to a place like Egypt to purchase an organ and have it transplanted there?
Ostensibly, this is definitely violations of human rights, and the various protocols that Dominique mentioned are in place, but it's incredibly difficult to track and enforce. This takes place completely underground, so being able to actually find the perpetrators, the brokers, the recruiters, is incredibly difficult. What is the organization or the oversight body that's actually going to do the enforcement or the punishment? It's just not there.
Well, Dominique, one of the countries that has sort of an interesting role in this is China, which has come under a lot of international criticism for alleged use of organs, I guess you couldn't call them donated organs, from prisoners who have been executed in Chinese prisons for transplant process. What do we know about this? How widespread was it? Is it still happening now?
So this was certainly widespread in China. That was China's method for procuring organs for transplantation for several years. Under pressure from the international community, obviously this is a huge violation of human rights, that policy and that practice has been rescinded in recent years, and China's been working very hard to develop a new ethical program of donation more consistent with international standards. But certainly that was the primary source of organs in China, and China was for several years a primary destination for people going to receive organs that had been taken from executed prisoners.
And Brendan Perrin, if we could just return to the ethics of it again, because, Campbell Fraser raised this interesting scenario where you have very desperate people coming from Syria now who have become a major source of organs, and people traveling to the Middle East to obtain organs from them. How is this particularly problematic? I mean, on some level, he mentioned that some of these donors are looking to get to Europe. They have no other way to get there. The people who receive the organ may have no other way to live.
I don't hold this against either the potential donor or the recipient. If this was my mother or your sister, right, you would do anything to get them the organ. So this isn't a problem of personal responsibility, but the policy has to control it. People are getting harmed in incredible ways. Both the donor and the recipient in these underground markets are not getting the care they need and end up with far worse outcomes than legitimate systems. So we need other solutions. And you know what those other solutions are? We need everyone who's listening to this interview to go register as an organ donor right now, as a deceased donor. We need living donors to be adequately compensated for their follow-up care, for their travel, and for other expenses.
Well, Dominique Martin, let me throw this to you then. Brendan Parent mentioned the importance of registering as a deceased organ donor. I myself am registered as a donor, but I understand in the United States, for example, there's something like 100 million people who have registered as organ donors, which is basically a third of the population, and yet there's still this huge list of people waiting for transplants. So it doesn't seem like purely getting organs from deceased donors is going to be able to resolve this problem.
So it's a complex problem, what we might call a wicked problem. The registrations, obviously, in the US are fantastic, but it is still a really rare opportunity for someone to die in circumstances where they could donate their organs for transplantation. That's something that's being worked on currently, so creating more opportunities, having, for example, people who can donate after they die in a manner where their heart stops, but they're not brain dead, which is, you know, what we've sort of traditionally thought of as the primary source of donated organs from the deceased. So I guess new models of organ procurement from people when they die. New things that we can do with organs that have been recovered from donors but in previous years would not have been suitable for transplantation. So being able to take hearts, livers, lungs even, that weren't perhaps ready to use, but putting them on machines where they can be repaired, so to speak, restored to a quality that then can be used successfully in transplantation. So we can get more out of the opportunities that we have for deceased donation. But definitely, as Brendan said, removing the barriers to living donation, often the financial barriers or the social barriers, lack of knowledge about opportunities to become a living donor. And then a whole range of particular methods, which I don't know if we want to go into the detail about other methods, but maybe a key point to mention is also prevention. As I think Shashank said, many of those needs for organ transplantation are the result of preventable diseases. So if we look after people with diabetes, hypertension, we address obesity issues, we're going to have fewer people progressing, developing kidney failure, and then ultimately needing a transplant. So not just waiting to spend all the money on the high-tech, high-cost transplantation, but working at the prevention end as well.
Well, Brendan, Dominique mentioned a number of different potential solutions here. How would we get some of these methods to developing nations? I mean, it's one thing for some of these systems to be changed in industrialized countries with sophisticated health systems, quite another to do them in much poorer countries.
That's true. We have to get the governments on board. They need to understand that this is a priority for their population. Get education into the schools about the importance of organ donation so that the next generation prioritizes registration as a deceased donor. Improve the social determinants of health, as Dominique mentions. Make sure we prioritize healthy diets and adequate access to good food so that we can prevent diabetes earlier. Make sure that these countries invest in new technologies so that in 20 years we'll actually be able to 3D print organs that will be perfect replicas of those that were damaged or lost for an individual.
Well, Dominique Martin, you heard Brendan Parent talk about the use of 3D printing. There are a number of promising technologies, it sounds like, that may change this debate. I understand that the use of stem cells is allowing the creation of potentially matchable organs. We've seen, I believe, an organ transplant from a pig to a human being already. Where do you see this debate moving over the next decade or two?
Probably a scientist is the right person to question about that, but certainly there are really promising signs in a lot of different fields. So I think I certainly couldn't put a date on it, but I think in 10 years' time, we're going to have, again, a lot more opportunities, a lot more alternatives, and hopefully see really some action in terms of preventing and finding solutions that don't require transplants.
And Brendan Parent, last word for you. Are you optimistic that 10 years from now, we'll still be looking at a situation where 20 people a day are dying on wait lists for organ transplants?
I'm an eternal optimist, an optimistic ethicist. I actually do believe that we will see a difference, and we will look back on today and shake our heads at this grotesque practice because now everybody has organs that don't cause ethical issues, that are able to be implanted and ensure quality life for many more years.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Brendan Parent, Dominique Martin, Shashank Bengali, and Campbell Frazier for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Taylor Campbell and Blythe Nebaker. Lauren Wertman is our supervising producer. Jiwon Choi is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer, and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.